Welcome to Accounting Influencers, the podcast for accounting leaders and influencers who want to know exactly what makes the good firms great and the great accountants world class. Let's get today's show started with your host and founder of the BD Academy, Rob Brown.
Welcome to the show, and I'm thrilled to have with me today an absolute legend and someone that I've admired for many years. It's Charles Jennings. Hello to you.
Hello, Rob. I'm really delighted to be here.
It is a thrill to have you on the show, Charles. You came on my radar many years ago when I was a school teacher, and I learned about how people learn in the workplace. So just for the benefit of listeners, would you tell us a bit about your background and your areas of expertise?
Sure, Rob. I'm not surprised you came across me when you were a school teacher. I was an academic for a long time.
Right.
I ran the UK National Centre for Network-Based Learning in the business school in Southampton. Then left academia about 25 years ago, went and worked in the financial markets initially, and then spent 8 years as chief learning officer for Reuters and then Thomson Reuters when those two organizations came together. And sprinkled in amongst that was a lot of consulting work and so on. And now I am a co-founder of an organization called the 70-20-10 Institute. And that's built around this 70-20-10 model where we work across the globe, really focusing on how we can build high performance across organizations.
Now, we'll dip into 70-20-10. As a concept. Did you stumble across it? Did you research into it? How did it come about?
I'd always had a feeling, backed up with some academic research, that training alone was never good enough to produce high performance.
Yeah.
It was an important element, but it wasn't enough. And yet, in our businesses, we often tend to think schooling and therefore revert to the school model. And then I was asked to come into Reuters in 2001 when the company had had major, major problems. In fact, a 150-year-old British institution was about to go under.
Mm.
A new CEO came in. I was asked to come in to look at training and learning and how the budget was and how effective it was and to build a strategy. And I'd come across 70-20-10 being used for accelerated leadership development within Goldman Sachs. I knew a little bit about it and I thought, well, why couldn't this simply be applied as a strategy across an organization? So that's what I did. And in fact, at Reuters, we put a new strategy in place based on 70-20-10. We improved efficiency and effectiveness, our budgets in terms of training and learning and everything from functional training right through to executive development.
Mm.
That was a success. Other organizations picked up on this, and now quite a lot of organizations use in one form or another this 70-20-10 approach. It's really based around a lot of research that shows that most of what we learn as part of work. We learn through other people, which is the 20, through social interaction, the informal coaching. It might be simply having a good manager who focuses on helping us do our jobs well. It might be understanding what exemplary performers do. That's the 20 piece. And the 70 piece is learning through experience and practice and reflection and understanding that the more we do things, the better we get at it.
Mm.
The 10 is the formal learning. People say to me, you're suggesting that 10 is not important. That's not the case. 10 is very important, but really that formal learning piece we see as being a license to operate. Of course, we need the formal learning for compliance, regulatory purposes or whatever. You know, we have to go through that process and it helps us get a start. Although I should say some organizations really do get people onboarded and started very, very quickly without formal, but generally formal is important, but it needs to be looked at as a baseline rather than as the way to really improve and accelerate performance across the organization.
Mm. And let's take a step back, Charles. When we talk about high performance, world class, we hear these phrases a lot. Can you actually wrap some definitions around that for us?
Yeah, that's a very good point, Rob. The way that we look at high performance or performance generally is from an organizational point of view. High performing organizations are those that are going to respond rapidly to changes.
Agility.
Absolutely, agility. In fact, a lot of 70-20-10 principles are embodied in processes such as lean and agile methodologies. In fact, we work a lot with organizations helping them utilize lean and agile into their people processes, in fact. So high performance is around how an organization can respond quickly, be agile, can continue to outperform others. And to do that, you require not just knowledge and skills. We tend to get caught into this knowledge and skills bucket and into this training bubble around that. But it's around making sure that everyone understands the best way to do things. Because in the knowledge industry, such as accountancy, high performers outperform average performers, not by one or two times, but actually by multiples.
So when we talk about high performance, it's not just the individual, it's the organization, the culture itself.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the challenges we've got is that still lots of organizations see learning as something which happens to individuals rather than something that happens for the organization.
Right.
But virtually none of the people listening to this podcast would say that they achieve their objectives alone. We all rely on others. We work in teams. We rely on other people all the time. It's rather strange because, of course, most HR processes are still based on individual performance. It's still, you know, the annual performance review and development objectives and so on are still based around the individual. Yet we all know that none of us can hit our targets, meet our objectives alone. So we need to take a step back and think about how the organization is performing and what is needed to make sure that our organization continues to thrive.
So in that sense, we can begin to define what makes a good accounting firm great, can't we? And for an accounting firm, you could put in any organization, couldn't you? What makes the good great?
That's right. What makes organizations great isn't that people know everything, that their people are very knowledgeable. Of course, that is going to help in accountancy. It means things such as error rates reduce, challenges by HMRC go down. Those sorts of things make the advice accountancy firms give to their clients result in positive impact. And one of the challenges that we have is when they think about learning, they think about schooling, and they think about measuring learning rather than measuring performance. And if we're looking to produce high performance, we have to focus on the performance side. Of course, the learning in order to do things is important, but the learning from doing work, the learning from carrying out activities is important.
How coachable do you feel people like accountants are? How learnable, how teachable? Because we know that they're technically brilliant. They've studied all kinds of qualifications. They've been hard at that. But when they get into the workplace, how malleable are they in taking on new knowledge and skills?
I think there's no difference within the accountancy profession than any other profession in terms of the people there.
Right.
Depends on some key factors. It depends on leadership, the quality of leadership and the focus of leadership on driving their organizations upwards and onwards and doing it in a way that focuses on getting the best out of people. That's what really counts. Where you see problems, whether it's in accountancy or whether it's in any other organization, almost unwaveringly, you can detect the culture of the organization through whether the leadership walks the walk and talks in terms of building high performance. That's where you see it happens. When I was at Reuters, I was very fortunate to have a CEO, a man called Tom Gloser, who absolutely understood this. And in all my time there, he never turned down any request for me for a meeting or to get him to come and talk to managers and so on. He really understood this. He drove stock price from Reuters from £6 to £15. So that sort of leadership is really important. But it's not just top of the house. It's also people who are managers of people. So every individual needs to realize that they have two responsibilities. One is operational excellence. Obviously, they need their team to perform well. But in order to do that, they really have a responsibility to develop their people.
Yeah.
And that can't be seen as a trade-off. Very often, I get into a room of managers and they say, well, we're actually too busy. We don't have time to develop our people. That's the job of HR or learning and development. Actually, that sort of thinking is not going to lead to high performance because the research shows that managers who are effective and focused at developing their people, as well as achieving operational excellence, those people will outperform others by about 25%. That's an extra day's work a week. In fact, I often say to managers, how would you like everyone in your organization to do an extra day's work? No cost to the organization, no cost to you. If you want to do that, what you need to do is focus on helping and developing your people. And that's by simply making sure that things such as your fortnightly or monthly meeting with your reports are not simply functional meetings, but are meetings around development meetings, asking questions such as, what challenges have you got? What successes have you had? What would you do next time? What have you learned from that? Just building that into the DNA of how you operate. The challenges that we have to improve performance and increase our effectiveness, those pressures are on us all the time to do more with less and so on. So we actually need to do this. It's not an option. Focusing on developing through work, what we call informal learning, it's not an option. It's absolutely a necessity. If we don't focus on that, we're not going to succeed.
Yeah. So my company here is a training company. We are called the Business Development Academy, and we train accountants to win work. So it's not the technical side. It's the building relationships, networking, asking for referrals, growing their reputation. You might call this the soft skills. And a big part of our methodology is face-to-face training because we know it makes an impact. But I am well aware that training isn't sufficient to build high performance in accounting firms. So just unpack that for us. Why doesn't it really work?
I think that's a really good point, Rob. Bringing people into a room, face-to-face training can be really effective for specific purposes. So in your work, you're looking to build soft skills. You're looking to build certain capabilities. You're looking to build engagement. You're dealing with behaviors.
Yes.
And
I'm trying, Charles, not just to create short-term impact, but long-term sustainable behavioral change, which is often in mindset as much as skills.
Absolutely. And if you're looking to change mindset and build specific behaviors, there's probably no better way to do it than to get people in a room.
Right.
Giving them training, in other words, improving their knowledge through maybe e-learning programs is not likely to do that. But on the other hand, if you're looking looking for people to really move from being good to being great, you need focus on them becoming reflective, giving them environments when they can reflect on what they've done, reflect on what goes well, reflect on doesn't go well. I've worked with organizations where simply by including those three questions I put a little while ago into a team meeting or a manager meeting or to a manager and report meeting has huge effect. And those three questions are, what have you done since we last met? So if I'm, for example, a manager and I have a team member, I would ask these questions. What's been going on for you since we last met? What successes have you had? What challenges have you not been able to address? In other words, what's keeping you up at night? We can talk about that. Then the next question following on that is, well, if you could roll back the time, what would you do different? And the third question is, well, what have you learned from that? Now, those simple three questions are really, really powerful enablers of performance, because simply giving a bit of space to reflect on what's gone well, what hasn't gone well, what other ways could you address the issue and what you've learned, it starts to change the mindset. We're learning because we're doing something and we reflect on it and we do it differently. That's what learning is about. The definition of learning is actually behavior change. There's no other definition of learning. You know, it's that our behaviors change and hopefully improve. So simple techniques like that are really powerful. And I've seen that used right from the level of first line managers talking to their functional reports through to teams of senior leaders who simply close their laptops and put away their pens for an hour during their quarterly meetings and go around the team and just answer those questions. What questions have I had? What challenges am I still facing? If I had my time over again, what would I do differently? What have I learned from that? And that changes mindset.
I love those questions. And I certainly embrace your methodology, because I say to managing partners of large firms, look, if we come in and do a program, in and of itself, it will change very little. There needs to be a coaching culture. There needs to be embedding of the learning. And I offer that to them, or I get them to confirm to me that their culture internally is enough to keep that going and ask those kinds of questions. So presumably, there are ways that organizations can overcome the deficiencies of training.
There certainly are. And one of the first steps that needs to be taken is this understanding that although good training can be very powerful, it's really not enough.
Yes.
It's never going to be enough.
And it's a starting point, isn't it?
And Rob, we've known this for years and years. Two academics called Thorndike and Woodworth did some research and wrote a paper in 1901 called The Theory of Identical Elements.
Back then?
Absolutely. So 120 years ago.
Goodness.
And the theory of identical elements says, fundamentally, it says the closer to the point of use that learning occurs, the more effective it's going to be. If the environments are identical, learning something in that environment is going to be much more effective than if the environments are very different. One of the challenges we have with training, when we take people away from their workplace, away from that environment, train them, and then we put them back into the workplace and expecting magic to happen, because transfer of skills and people's performance in a learning environment don't necessarily transfer well into a work environment. So one of the fundamental principles of 70-20-10 is that if we can focus on bringing working and learning together, and we learn from work as well as learn to work, we're likely to be much more effective and our organizations are likely to benefit.
Yeah. So we talked about the 10%, the formal training. It does have a role to play and it can be a great catalyst for getting people into a learning environment. But beyond that, we're talking about the 20% next. Just unpack that for us. What kind of things does that involve?
So I always call it the 20 rather than the 20%, because
right.
I'm not talking about percentages. People think, oh, this is some sort of formula. Well, it's not, of course.
But it does add up to 100, so it is convenient in that way. And I'm sure you did it that way.
That's right. In the original work from where 70-20-10 came, the original numbers weren't nice round numbers either. If we unpack the 20, that's where we can utilize the experience of others. So, for example, a lot of work we do at the 70-20-10 Institute is focused around identifying exemplary performers and then looking at the critical tasks that they undertake. Because in almost any field, whether it's in accountancy, whether it's in medicine, whether it's in law, whatever it might be, almost always you'll find that high performers, exemplary performers, do a few things differently to others. And it's often not a lot. It's often four or five things that are different. And it's often not just following the rules. In fact, we do a lot of work in production environments, in industrial environments. And it's very interesting when you talk to high performers. They say, well, of course, the standard operating procedures say this, but actually you work around that because this is a much better way to do it.
Yeah.
One of the elements of the 20 is understanding what it is that makes high performers, what differentiates them, and then being able to share that and embed that. Another element of the 20 is the coaching piece in terms of either having high performers coach others or making sure that we embed some coaching capabilities into people who are in a position to do that. So that might be peer coaching, it might be manager coaching, it might be something like a reverse coaching or reverse mentoring where younger people fresh into the organization actually mentor people who've been there for a long time, more senior people. And again, we know that high levels of innovation, the great breakthroughs in human history haven't come from from crusty old academics and professors and people who've been working in their field for many years. They often come from people who have a new view of what's happened. They come in without all the encumbered baggage. Albert Einstein couldn't even get an academic job when he graduated. You know, he was working as a patent clerk when he did his work. People like Watson and Crick, Francis Crick, hadn't been working with DNA, I think 18 months before he'd come in from another field. And so thinking about those within your own organization and then working out ways in which you can exploit the experience and the knowledge of exemplary performers. You can exploit the potential new eyes, new views of new people coming into the organization or younger people coming into the organization. Those sorts of things, there's many, many sorts of things you can do in that 20 space other than simply say, we're going to put in a coaching program or a mentoring program.
Can anyone be a coach, Charles? I can hear some partners high up in accounting firms saying to me, well, I'm not a coach. I've never been a coach. They get on with it. They do their own thing.
Well, it often takes some time. So let me give some advice to senior partners that comes with a bit of a bitter pill, but it does take some work to develop both the techniques for coaching and also the elements of empathy. The other thing that is worthwhile thinking about if you're a senior partner is that often telling someone about your own experiences is not the most effective way of developing them. There's some research with the Corporate Leadership Board, which is an organization in the US, where they identified 15 actions that managers or leaders could take which improve performance. And giving advice from your own experience was number 15.
Goodness me.
It did have a positive impact. All of these 15 actions had positive impact, but giving advice from your own experience was number 15. The top three were around giving people the opportunities to stretch their work. In other words, challenging them, giving them stretch alignments, giving them opportunities to work. The second one was around giving people the opportunity to reflect on what they were doing. And those three questions I mentioned come play very well to that. So giving time just to reflect. And the most powerful, thing a manager can do is set clear objectives. Tell people what's expected of them and how they're going to be measured. And that, interestingly, is the most impactful thing. So making sure that people have clarity of objectives, they're aligned with organizational objectives, they know how they're going to be measured right from the start, then giving them strict work, allowing them to be challenged, and then giving them time to reflect. They are the three most powerful things. So whether you're a senior leader, a middle manager, or a first level manager, they're the three most powerful things. Giving it your own experience can help, but not a lot.
So we talked about the 10, we talked about the 20. They're very much intentional, purposeful. The 70 isn't. Talk to us about that.
Well, learning through working. 70 is partly from practice and experience and reflection, but it's also by having absolute clarity around your processes. So making sure if you want to improve in the 70, and the 70 and 20 is where the real impacts come.
It's on the job stuff, isn't it, Charles?
It's on the job stuff. But it's not just sort of learning from doing things and saying, hey, that worked well or this didn't work well. It's around making sure that there's double loop learning and that we learn, we change things, we learn again, making sure that we have clarity in terms of this is the way we carry out procedures, processes in this organization, and having continuous improvement. 70, 20, 10 is as much about continuous improvement as it is about learning it. Also, one of the large areas that we work in and that we found to be very powerful in the 70 space is in providing people with support to do their jobs. It's what's called performance support. Rather than providing people with maybe an e-learning program to follow, it's providing them with something that they can use in order to help them perform at that point or near that point of need. And of course, in our lives away from work, I'm sure all of us use performance support all the time. You know, we want to take the back off our watch, for example. What do? We go to YouTube and look at choose one from the hundreds of little videos that show us how to take the back off our watch or fix our car or whatever.
It's become a new verb, Charles. Did you hear that to YouTube something is now a verb?
Oh, is it really?
Yeah. My daughter said when I asked them the other day, they said, have you YouTubed it? So it's now it's now in parlance as a verb.
Doesn't surprise me. And it's interesting because that's the way humans work. You know, we only really learn when we learn close to the point of use. We learn best close to the point of use. And if we can provide the resources and the help at that point of use or near to that point of use, it's likely to be much more effective. And IBM researchers 10 or 15 years ago, they showed that when you separate learning from working, sure, when you do that well, you will improve the value. But the closer you get to the point of use, if you can help at that point, the increase in value is huge.
Yeah. So for the leaders, managers, partners listening, what does this mean for them in terms of the practical day-to-day changes?
It means that they have to think slightly differently. Or if they're thinking this way, they need to reinforce it. And that thinking is, my job as a leader or a manager, of course, it's to deliver results for the organization. It's to take the organization forward. It's to make sure that the organization remains relevant, remains productive, and remains profitable. That's one part. But the other part is, is it's absolutely critical that every manager is involved in process improvement. Every manager is involved in people improvement. In other words, how do we break down the barriers that are inhibiting people performing to their top level? I'm very positive in my outlook. I believe that most people in work want to do a good job. There might be a small percentage who don't, but generally people want to do their best.
Yeah.
When we look at employee engagement figures across the board, generally they're pretty low. What that says to me is there are things inhibiting people doing their jobs. And we've all been there. We all get frustrated because systems aren't in place or systems work against us doing our jobs well. So a manager's role within that 70-20-10 context is helping people develop, increasing agility, removing what we call environmental barriers, taking away things which are stopping people doing their job well, and thinking with a mindset of continuous improvement, thinking that there are opportunities every day to get better, to tweak processes, to maybe change procedures, to provide a bit more support, help, performance support, all those sorts of things. Actually, a manager is and a leader is best person to do that.
Yeah. So presumably, Charles, when we know that this is working, this collaboration, this innovation, these high-performing teams, what are some of the upsides and signs that 70-20-10 is in operation?
Well, the things to look for are your organizational metrics, your business mix. You're not looking for whether people have the knowledge and skills and things like that. In the accountancy world, you'll be looking for productivity figures. You know, are you utilizing your resources in a better way? Are you decreasing error rates?
But what about the things that don't have metrics, Charles? Collaboration, innovation, breaking down silos, talking to people, those kind of things, building relationships. They don't have metrics in themselves, do they?
They don't have metrics in themselves, but the output of that will be seen in organizational success.
Okay.
Rob, you will also see changes in culture. You'll see moving from the old idea that knowledge was power, so people held on to their expertise, to a sharing, that access to knowledge is power. So therefore, changing this culture from a culture of maybe silos to a sharing culture, those sorts of things, you'll certainly see that. But the metrics to look for are the organizational metric. If it's an organization which is on the stock market, what is the stock price doing? What's the share value? Those sorts of things, they're the metrics we look for. And that's pretty tough. If you're working in an HR world or a people world, it's a bit of a change in terms of starting to think about the sharp end of the organization.
Yeah, this is great, Charles. And if people want to have a conversation with you, learn more about the great stuff that the 70-20-10 Institute does, what's the best way for them to reach you?
Well, the best way to reach me is on any of the social media. So you'll find me on LinkedIn as Charles Jennings, but also the 70-20-10 Institute website, which is simply 70-20-10institute.com. You'll see there's lots of articles, papers, case studies, and so on. So you can find me there. I'd be really delighted to talk to anyone who thinks that we might be able to help them.
And when you go into these organizations, what kind of things do you do for them?
We often go in to help organizations from a strategic point of view, but sometimes we simply go in on what we call a proof of impact. We go in to look at a particular issue and a problem, and then we always work in a very pragmatic and practical way, and we design an approach to demonstrate impact of doing things differently. And that usually starts the ball rolling. You know, we're very practical. We're not just thinking about these things and writing books about these things. We actually have a set of solutions that we work with organizations to deliver the value.
I get that. And you've been marvelously practical today. Would you leave us with some encouraging words to the leaders, the partners, the coaches out there listening that want to create better teams and even perform at a higher level themselves?
Yeah, the positive messages I'd leave would be that I haven't been into an organization yet which is performing at absolute optimal level. There's always a lot of headroom. And when you see organizations and leaders and managers and people who are working as coaches and so on, when you see people achieving impact in those organizations and then see the benefits that come out, actually, it becomes so damn obvious that that's the way to do it. The one message I would leave you with is if you are a leader of an organization or a senior manager, your most important job is not just to develop your people, but to make sure that the barriers that those people may face are reduced as much as possible. So you're focused on people, you're focused on process, you're focused on productivity, you're focused on those sorts of things. They all come together. You can't separate them off and pass developing people off to HR and learning and development and pass maybe process off to your lean team. You have to do the whole lot.
Yeah. And finally, Charles, I must ask you, how important is it that leaders, senior managers are coachable themselves, that they are a good role model, that they model the behavior that they want other people to follow?
It's absolutely critical. If managers and leaders don't walk the walk, don't display the behaviors that they're expecting of others, the organization is not likely to succeed on it. I think one lesson we're learning is that the era of the heroic leader is passing. And a man I know who's a very, very eminent expert in leadership, a man called Henry Mintzberg, talks about community ship. So Henry talks about the fact that leaders need to be community leaders rather than heroic leaders. And when we look around, we're certainly seeing that change.
Yeah. Well, that's a great point to finish on. Charles Jennings, that's been world Klaus, thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks very much.
You've been listening to Accounting Influencers, the podcast for accounting leaders and influencers who want to know exactly what makes the good firms great and the great accountants world class. For show notes on today's and other episodes, plus some great blogs and resources to help accountants lead, sell, and perform at the highest levels, go to bdacademy.pro. Until next time, have a fantastic day.